Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 59, right at the beginning, which is old single column, page 672. Okay, so now we're very much ready to do these three papers in this whole block here that, you know, very definitively step you through block of time by block of time, you know, through the meat of the evolution of life. And, you know, they give you a little thumbnail sketch right at the beginning of this paper, just, you know, indicating that fact that they're about to really, you know, we've done all of the preliminary, and we've had our little detours where we've considered the issues off to the side a little bit. Now they want to just take you through the basics of what happened subsequent to that first suddenly that we read last time. Suddenly, we had the first protozoa, you know, the first single-celled animals. Things get going in a very definitive way, lickety-split. It's very much a purposed phenomenon. So there's once you finally have evolutionary life, you have eukaryotic life in contrast to that prokaryotic life. The God of evolution, God the Mother, very definitively takes a hold of that phenomenon, and it begins to evolve, and suddenly start coming fast and furious. Right, phase changes in the system manifest one after another as this influence, you know, that's been waiting to be able to latch on to evolutionary life, you know, just you know, it's basically a constant influence, like we talked about. You know, no one's turning up the knob to make a suddenly. It's basically a constant influence. The background has been established in a, you know, relatively constant mode by the master physical controllers. So again, relatively constant influence, you know, in all ways imposed upon the system. And off it goes. There's gradualies and then suddenlies and then gradualies and then suddenlies and on and on and on and on. Okay. You know, and every time you get a suddenly, you get a new species, it in that vertical evolutionary process, it immediately moves in a horizontal evolution process and fills in all the horizontal niches. You know, and then somewhere there's a suddenly, and it, you know, goes up vertically to the next notch and, you know, spreads out horizontally again there. So you start to get this you know, this branching phenomenon developing. It's going up, but it's also spreading outward. All right, so let's just, why don't you, you know, not only read the little tiny preface, you know, thing there, but items 1 through 5, let's get them all, and then we'll talk about them.
Paper 59, the marine life era on Urantia. We reckon the history of Urantia as beginning about 1 billion years ago and extending through 5 major eras. 1, the pre-life era, extends over the initial 450 million years from about the time the planet attained its present size to the time of life establishment. Your students have designated this period as the Archaeozoic. 2, the Life Dawn era extends over the next 150 million years. This epoch intervenes between the preceding pre-life or cataclysmic age and the following period of more highly developed marine life. This era is known to your researchers as the Proterozoic. 3, the marine life era covers the next 250 million years and is best known to you as the Paleozoic. 4, The early land life era extends over the next 100 million years and is known as the Mesozoic. 5. The mammalian era occupies the last 50 million years. This recent times era is known as the Cenozoic.
Okay. So those three chapters, of which this is the first, are just those last three, items 3, 4, and 5. We've made it through the first two. So we'll have this first paper here, paper 59, on the Paleozoic. And paleo, meso, ceno, and you have these prefixes attached to that root, zoic. Zoic means life. Okay, and there's a little playing to the literalness in that last statement about the Cenozoic. And it says, this recent times era. Ceno means recent. Okay, it's recent life. Yeah, that's why they said it that way. All right, so with paleo, meso, ceno, you have early, middle, recent life. The former life, former to the Cambrian explosion of life and the beginning of the Paleozoic, that's the Proterozoic, that former life, that initial eukaryotic life. Item number one, right, we see it again like we've talked about. Okay, it says the pre-life era. However, it's called the Archaeozoic, right, which means ancient life. Right, there isn't eukaryotic life, but there's prokaryotic life, like we've seen. Right, that ancient, so-called ancient life, all those prokaryotes, those living machines, the life carriers, specifically the primary associators built and the life carriers animated, we're going. You see them using, just like with the life establishment, that's eukaryotic life establishment, like we just read in the previous paper. Prokaryotic was established way, way, way back. And, you see they're doing just like they said. They're basically having, quote-unquote, Urantia, having a heavenly place initiated a billion years ago. And the planet is basically its current full size, and in short order, the primary associators show up, and you start getting things put on the life registries, and things get going. Now, in terms, everything's all just basically factual, but a few little things that they've thrown in there, In that, hearkening back to the Proterozoic that we've just gone through, notice what they say there. This epoch intervenes between the preceding pre-life or cataclysmic age and the following period of more highly developed marine life. Throwing in that cataclysmic age. The reason for that is they're reminding you that prior to the Proterozoic, the planet was still in a state, in a circumstance where there were a lot of cataclysms, both internally generated and externally generated. It could be a very large meteor impact, say, or something. So you haven't gotten to the validity of one of those fundamental principles of geology, uniformitarianism. All right? You still have a distinct amount of catastrophism in play. That the contrast that was coined oh so long ago, like we were talking about, started to be used by Charles Lyell and those founders of modern geology. And, that contrast between catastrophism, in other words, thinking in biblical, Genesis terms about the formation of the earth, Or is the history of the Earth basically an extension of the processes that you see going on right now, just extrapolating back in time? You know, there's a uniform domain of processes and basic nature of the planet. Obviously, you know, until the planet is roughly its current size, you can't even begin to think about that being valid, right? That age could be gotten to in some truth by extrapolating backward in a uniform fashion from the present. You know, but they're reminding you there. You know, but technically, they're not going to plant eukaryotic life when things are still in a cataclysmic age, quote unquote. Right? That's too disruptive. So, you know, in all sorts of ways, everything has been kind of brought down to a stabilized mode. Right? We saw that the ratio of radiometric date to actual date, was brought down definitively to in the ballpark of 1.5. It's right now where we are. It's about 1.4. Instead of four, instead of a factor of four. So that clamping things down. And see, in all ways, everything is settled into a pretty reasonable state where there's a relative uniform phenomenon going forward. However, we know one important thing that's not valid that we've talked about to extrapolate backward like they do. Right now, the planet has plate tectonics. Right, you can't extrapolate that back very far. Right, you go back, just a little ways, and the crust was not rigid enough to have plates and plate tectonics. Right, and you were in that mode, as you see the Revelters will remind us of that. It's more appropriate to use that older term of continental drift. Right? And to understand what's going on in that mode. Now, don't try to rationalize things way back here where we're about to read with a plate tectonic phenomenon. That's not valid. And, of course, that's what scientists are doing right now. Right? So there's all kinds of little hints that they're throwing in relative to that, trying to give you data points to anchor a better geology to so you can have a true geology, historical geology of the planet, predicated on facts that we just don't appreciate, like that. What can't be extrapolated? You have no access to it all by extrapolation or anyway guessing or anything. I mean, it's just you have to just be told, it's like, oh, that's what no wonder that's so confusing back there and those sorts of things. Right? So, like I've said several times, we won't dwell on the basic science, here, because we're certainly trying to acquire the truth first before we try to burrow down into the details of the facts. But occasionally, it's very important to just notice what kind of factual items they put in there, and to think about, well, why did they say that? Of all the things they could have said, why did they say that? Why is that something that is necessary for a revelation to tell us? So that's the point of them throwing in that cataclysmic there. Yep.
Hey, refresh my memory on the first period of the Archozoic. You were talking about prokaryotic. Is there any life today that was? Prokaryotic?
Yeah, all bacteria are prokaryotes. Every mitochondria in your body is a prokaryote. Every chloroplast in a plant is a prokaryote.
So that was active on the rocks and dirt that were here and that kind of stuff, right?
Right. Yeah. Obviously things are not in the mode they were way back then when they were just initially terraforming the planet. Right, but there's definitely ongoing. If there weren't prokaryotes, organic materials wouldn't decay, right? You need those bacteria to decay organic material. A tree falls in the forest, it would just sit there unmoved forever, like a rock, right?
Well, just showing the flagellin bacteria, you've seen that thing too, where it actually shows the design of a Right. It looks like an outboard motor. It actually shows the construction of how designed it is. It's kind of fascinating.
Not only was eukaryotic life designed and built, but so was prokaryotic life.
Yeah. Yeah.
Built you know, fundamentally in the image of the master physical controllers as little power plants. That have an input and output and process things, right? All right. So there you have it. See, there, like I said, notice how it kind of feels like we're sort of starting anew. See, like I said, we're done with kind of the preliminary stuff, and we're now going to sort of officially get to, here's like a, you know, a really kind of a basic historical geology text, you know, and we're going to step along through time. And give a little bit about the biology and the geology, you know, in each little moment of time. Okay, read that next tiny little block there.
The marine life era thus covers about one quarter of your planetary history. It may be subdivided into six long periods, each characterized by certain well-defined developments in both the geologic realms and the biologic domains.
All right, so... So we're going to work, like I said, through the Paleozoic here, and that's broken up into smaller blocks, the first of which is the Cambrian. You know, so they're going to take you basically a section at a time, right, through those smaller blocks of geologic time. And as a little aside, coincidentally, and I'm putting that in quotes. You know, when they point out that, you know, you divide the Paleozoic up like this, you actually can break up the whole big picture, like they just did above, into six as well. Right? There's that previous block prior to a billion years ago. You know, so from 4.5 billion to 1 billion years ago, there's another block of time there that you can name in the same manner, where, you know, it's all about, the only reason that there's anything happening here, it's all about life, right? The planet is evolving to be inhabited. It's the history of life. That prior to the Archaeozoic, you have what you can call the Azoic, without life, literally. Right? So there, you have six eras, right? The Azoic, the Archaeozoic, the Proterozoic, the Paleozoic, the Mesozoic, and the Cenozoic. And the first three, you know, it breaks into two halves. You have the first three and then the second three. And it's those second three that we're really going to be studying now, where you very much have easily discoverable in the fossil record, you know, visible life. It's a lot, like we mentioned, initially it wasn't even noticed that there was life prior to the Paleozoic. And then they discovered, oh, actually there was. Yeah, every once in a while you run across a little something that managed to get fossilized. You know, and so they called it, well, there's this former life, right, prior to what they thought was the beginning. Right, so you have this kind of hidden part to begin with, and then it's very much visible from starting to beginning of the Paleozoic going forward. All right. Let's see, maybe one little thing just to say right here. When they say each characterized by certain well-defined developments in both the geologic realms and the biologic domains, remember again, that's how you can figure out what the ratio is between the radiometric date and the actual date. Right? You look at the description of a certain geologic or biologic event in the Urantia book, and you match that up with the scientists. You know, speaking about that particular, say, geologic event, and they've managed to attach a radiometric date to it, and then you look at what the actual date is in the Urantia book, and so you know what that calibrating ratio is. All right, Okay, so that's...
So 1.4 you're talking
about. Yeah, so like right now it's 1.4 is in the time frame we're in here. You know, so that's, you know, you see how they, you know, they, if that wasn't obvious, they literally put a statement in there to try to stress that, to get you to focus in properly. So you aren't immediately off on this false track thinking that radiometric dates that scientists talk about can be just, you know, compared directly to the dates in here, you know, and the scientist says 300 million years ago, and you flip in the Urantia book and find where it says 300 million. No, no, I mean, if you actually look at what they're talking about, they're not talking about the same thing. You know, and if you have some mystical relationship to reality, right, you're going to go, oh, the Urantia book is saying that despite everything that humans see, you know, it's not there. You know, we see a dinosaur, but there really wasn't dinosaurs. Ooh, things are very mystical. No. You know, you've made a false initial assumption. Right? I mean, look, you know, if scientists are talking about Triceratops, you got to go to the place in the book where they're talking about Triceratops, right, to match it up. You'll notice, the dates aren't the same. Right? Okay. Keep going here.
As this era begins, the sea bottoms, the extensive continental shelves, and the numerous shallow nearshore basins are covered with prolific vegetation. The more simple and primitive forms of animal life have already developed from preceding vegetable organisms, and the early animal organisms have gradually made their way along the extensive coastlines of the various land masses until the many inland seas are teeming with primitive marine life. Since so few of these early organisms had shells, not many have been preserved as fossils. Nevertheless, the stage is set for the opening chapters of that great stone book of the life record preservation, which was so methodically laid down during the succeeding ages.
Okay, just 3 points there. Remember how they said, you know, back in the Proterozoic, that things were still patchy, right? There might be some life in, you know, these shallow seas, but not in those, or maybe not down in any part of these ocean depths. Now we've gotten to the point where, you know, it's basically everywhere. Everywhere it can get to, right? You know, there might be some inland sea that has never been open to the ocean, and so it hasn't managed to get itself in there yet. But, you know, everywhere, every nook and cranny it can get into without having being able to actually go across land yet, right? There's no land animals. It's gotten there. So things are, you can, just about anywhere you find these aged rocks, right, you can expect to find fossils. You're not going to get unlucky and just happen to have picked a part that didn't have any life there, but, you know, back then. Okay, so that's an important point. So it makes it much more straightforward to sort things out. And it's obviously a lot harder to figure out what's going on if the fossil record is patchy, right, for us today, you know, trying to just occasionally dig up some rocks and try to figure out what's going on. You know, you've got all, like they're saying, you know, just, you know, all that everywhere. And then just a little aside, they'll get to it kind of more specifically in a bit, but you can kind of see it between the lines right here. When they mention shells, since so few of these early organisms had shells, not many have been preserved as fossils. Okay, yes, but in between the lines is, oh, shells very early on, way before there's any predators, right? This is a very important thing, right? I mean, currently, you know, evolutionary biologists try to rationalize everything, as some response, you know, that, you know, there's just random things being generated and, you know, and there's predators. And so, of course, you know, the ones that don't have shells, you know, don't survive, and the ones that have shells do, and that's why there's things with shells. And it's like, no, this is all purposed. Long, long before any creature needs a shell, for really kind of any reason, it has a shell. Right? That's an important point. You'll see that occasionally throw in, often kind of subtly about that. Right? I mean, it's almost as if someone knew that one day an animal would need a shell, and so here they have shells. Yeah, that's right. It's those behind this know the end from the beginning. Right? It's all designed in. Right? So long before something is needed, coincidentally, now I'm putting it in quotes, that which is needed is in place. Okay? Like shells. So just note that. You can often see lots of very furious rationalization with paleontologists trying to sort this stuff out with their magical random life generator model.
Is that kind of like the quote that the father knows what you need long before you ask him?
Exactly, right, yeah. When Jesus tells you to not worry because, you know, just look at how the Father takes care of, you know, the birds and the, right. I mean, even the lowliest animals are cared for, right? I mean, they're eventually going to need shells to be able to survive. And so it's seen to it that they have them, that those evolve long before they need them. Okay. And so that's a key point about the truth that's flowing through the story here, right? The truth that it's purposed, right? And then you go, huh? And look at they brought it in again. Remember, I told you they remember how at the end of the previous paper, besides giving you little hints that, you know, they're certainly aware of Charles Lyell's book. They also threw in that stone book thing, very much suggesting that that the great stone book of nature, right, and I told you that book back from 1863 by David Thomas Anstead. They were certainly aware of that and are probably, not necessarily directly pulling from it, but using it as a basic template, for our knowledge and how we've tried to coordinate it, and they're leveraging off of that, occasionally trying to help us with our confusion as they can see as we try to tell the story in those books. I'd say you see it again. And here I'll mention something that definitely gets you very suspicious, that it isn't just a coincidence that they're quoting Stone Book. And there's this book from that vintage, a famous text from that time span that has Stone Book in the title. If you look at the chapters in Anstead's book, the 14th chapter in that book is entitled The Pre-Adamite World. Yeah, that I'm sure they saw that. It's like, oh, that's just too good to, because they know they're definitely going to use that term for the descendants of Adam and Eve to call them Adamites. And now what Anstead means by that is pre-historical times. Right? Where basically history begins with the story of Adam and Eve. But just delightfully, he uses that Adamite term, pre-Adamite world. When you finally get to very recent times and you start to discover not just rocks, but curiously shaped rocks that look like someone used them for a spearhead or a stone tool of some sort, right? Yeah. So that, just adds to the likelihood, right, that they're very much using that as a basic touchstone, that book. And I'll point to something else that comes up here in a little bit too. Just the fact, like I said, that they repeat it. I mean, it's like did you notice that I said that? If not, I'll say it again. It's like it seems to be a pretty aggressive hint, right? Stolen book. Did you notice it? Okay, let's read another one here.
The continent of North America is wonderfully rich in the fossil-bearing deposits of the entire marine life era. The very first and oldest layers are separated from the later strata of the preceding period by extensive erosion deposits, which clearly segregate these two stages of planetary development.
Notice how they're referring to these, you know, sort of easily discernible boundaries. You know, so you have stuff being laid down in a marine environment, and then you've got a whole bunch of erosional stuff coming off an elevated continent and piling on. You know, and then you've got, you know, more marine stuff being laid down. You know, again, more just sort of, you know, within the marine ecosystem more immediately. Right, so just those sorts of things, you know, and a similar thing to having differences in what kind of stuff is being laid down like that. You often, when you're looking at the stratigraphy, you know, the stack of beds, sometimes you'll have two beds where you can tell they literally just came one right after the other in time. You know, there's a nice clean boundary. Something changed, you know, so there's a boundary, but it's, you know, there's no time gap. Other times, you can tell you have stuff that's been eroded, right? And then subsequently, stuff has been laid on top of that, right? So you have a discontinuity there in time. You have to take into account all those sorts of issues as you're studying, you know, the Great Stone Book, right? You know, you have to read it carefully. Right, so if you're not familiar with those sorts of issues, if you have never taken geology, you know, those kinds of things are being brought to mind when they point out that. Okay, so now let's actually get to the process of stepping along in chunks of time here.
Section 1, Early Marine Life in the Shallow Seas, the Trilobite Age. By the dawn of this period of relative quiet on the Earth's surface, life is confined to the various inland seas and the oceanic shoreline. As yet, no form of land organism has evolved. Primitive marine animals are well established and are prepared for the next evolutionary development. Amoeba are typical survivors of this initial age of animal life, having made their appearance toward the close of the preceding transition period.
I mean, I already mentioned them, right? I mean, you got amoebas. These single-celled animals and other, you know, protozoa. So that's the basic situation that's coming forward out of the protozoic. Remember, the last block we had was dated 450 million years ago, and you can see 400 million years ago is coming up. Okay, so that 50 million years, is they're just reminding you of that. And the stage is getting very much set for something more profound to happen. We had single-celled animals and you began to have then colonies of single-celled animals. But we don't have any multicellular animals yet. Right. You know, a colony of single cells is where, you know, you can take one of those single cells out of that colony creature, right? And it'll function as a single-celled organism. You know, it has everything it needs all within it, right? You don't have differentiation of cells, right? Skin cells and, you know, heart cells and whatnot, right? You know, they're all the same, but they're working together in a colony because you have, remember I told you, you have that collective mode of an adjutant can engage them, right? So they're not just, it's not just, the adjutants aren't just engaging individual creatures, they can go to that higher mode of the adjutant and engage a collective as well as the individuals. And that's all we have up to this point. And now something very profound is going to happen, okay? A very profound phase change in the system. You're not going to build a multicellular animal and plop it on the planet, right? It's just going to suddenly all those undifferentiated cells are going to be a collection of differentiated cells, and you're going to have a multicellular organism. Yeah. Okay.
400 million years ago, marine life, both vegetable and animal, is fairly well distributed over the whole world. The world climate grows slightly warmer and becomes more equable. There is a general inundation of the seashores of the various continents, particularly of North and South America. New oceans appear, and the older bodies of water are greatly enlarged.
Okay, so again, stressing how it's you have life everywhere. So you have life being subject to kind of all the variations of stimuli, right? So you know that there's already probably been lots of horizontal evolution, you know, filling in all those different niches, all the slight little differences. You very much have an oceanic or a marine climate. Right? It's dominated by the water. The climate is dominated by the water. So it's in general warm. You know, and there's pointing out it's actually going to get a little bit warmer here. And you know, we don't know the total reason. Maybe the sun decided the planet was going to be warmer or whatever. But it's going to be a little bit warmer. But you notice more equable, right? There's less fluctuations, you know, like the climate of Hawaii, right? Where it's basically warm and there's not much variation over the course of the year, right? All of that water, provides inertia that, prevents significant fluctuations. So the whole planet is like that, right? Pretty much the same temperature year round and from equator to pole, right? There really isn't any variation, any radical variation of temperature from the equator to the pole or, between summer and winter in either hemisphere, right? Okay, so very, very uniform sort of climate and very temperate. You already see them, and they'll mention this over and over again. You have all kinds, remember, we have this very plastic, flexible crust, and it's constantly undulating, and stuff is going below water, above water, and bending and flexing, and tongues of water are going into land, and it's a very malleable surface. It's constantly fluctuating. They say particularly North and South America here. New oceans appear, so large scale undulation. It's not just small scale, but large scale too. You want to think in this very variable way about the nature of the land, and all the creatures and plants are trying to keep up with all that. Okay?
Vegetation now for the first time crawls out upon the land and soon makes considerable progress in adaptation to a non-marine habitat.
Okay, so here we go. You can see why they put that in just a little paragraph by itself. That's a significant step. Right? I mean, animals aren't getting out of land, but you notice how they say vegetation now for the first time crawls out. Right? And they didn't do that just to be kind of cutesy anthropomorphic. Right? As I've been trying to stress. Everything that's evolving here is the evolution of humans, right? No matter how much it seems like it's plants, and amoebas and whatnot, right? The whole point is that inherently everything is purposed to produce will creatures, right? And so even if the plants don't in fact crawl out onto the land, you could say in truth they do, right? There, it's a foretaste of the animals crawling out on the land feast to come, right? That's why they did that, to just try to stress, to think about the truth of what's happening. Don't start with all the facts first. In truth, the plants are the humans too. Everything is the humans, right? And everything that's here on the planet right now besides the humans is just the human support system And at one time, it was the pre-human. Right? At one time, algae, pond scum was the human. You know, so, you know, when we look at our, you know, assess our lowly estate, you know, and we might consider ourselves nothing but pond scum, you know, relative to what you're going to be as a finaliter. Casey, you're not just, you know, being cute. Right? There's a truth to that. Right? Deep down in the core of your evolutionary nature, you still are pond scum. That's how you started. That's what humans looked like way back when. Right? And so, you know, you still can kind of unfortunately be, you know, a little more, not very much more profound than pond scum. Right? It's still within your repertoire.
Right? Okay.
It's just to appreciate that. It's very important to, you know, to not think in such divorced fashion about yourself. I mean, it's all one evolutionary system. And in an even bigger picture, like I stressed earlier on in these papers, right, the planet too is part of, you know, the evolution of humans. It's all one evolutionary system. To think of it that way, think of it holistically. First, part-wise second, not part-ways first and holistically never, like current scientists do, right? Start with the whole, start with the mother. You know, then consider the father-like parts. Before there can be any father-like parts, there first has to be a mother-like whole within which those parts are going to exist. All right, and you see how this next paragraph starts out here.
Suddenly, and without gradation ancestry, the first multicellular animals make their appearance. The trilobites have evolved, and for ages they dominate the seas. From the standpoint of marine life, this is the trilobite age.
Now, you notice they're purposely a little vague there. I mean, they aren't directly saying that suddenly there's trilobites, right? But suddenly there are things, and in very short order, right? I mean, they're as sophisticated as trilobites. Okay, now, again, if you're not familiar with the history of the planet, what you're ignorant of, one of the very big things you're ignorant of is trilobites. Trilobites are one of the most significant creatures that have ever lived on the planet in terms of, who used to be in charge. You know, what did the spear point of the evolutionary process once look like? Humans were trilobites way back then. That was the leading edge. They dominated the earth, right? And they're an arthropod, right? Crustacean-like, specifically. We'll get to those a lot here in a bit. You know, you have all those kind of names that they're such and so pod, right? You know, like cephalopod and things like that, right? Now, arthropod, what does that mean? You know, like insects and spiders and crustaceans and all these. Okay, the pod part means foot. Right? And then it's always a something foot. Right? And, you know, arthropod means, arthro means jointed. Right? So they have jointed feet. Okay? Like insects, you know, and crustaceans and whatnot, have jointed feet. Right? So now that general term is just indicating that. So trilobites, right, you know, they have all these jointed feet like insects, right, or crustaceans. And they're called trilobites, tri-lobe-ite. The very distinctive thing about them is longitudinally, you know, from head to tail, they have a central lobe and two side lobes. It's a very distinctive thing about the morphology, right, of their body. So that's why they're called trilobites. And there were zillions of different variations of them, and they were around for a long, 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 long time, hundreds of millions of years. So there's lots and lots of horizontal evolution of them, right?
Lots of fossils.
Yeah, lots and lots and lots and lots of fossils of trilobites. Yeah, yeah. You can easily go to any place that's selling fossils, and you can buy a rock with a nice little trilobite fossil in it, because they're just a dime a dozen. There's zillions of them. Really, really, really nice ones are cheap. You can get really beautiful trilobite fossils. They're quite cheap. Okay, so they're very fun. Just cool little creatures. Very much the trilobite age. I see they dominate the seas, like it says there. But the key, the amazing thing to really try to wrap your mind around is, you go from no differentiation of cells to the differentiation, full differentiation of the cells of a living organism in one step, right? Suddenly there's a multicellular creature, like we were saying before. I mean, which came first, the chicken or the egg? The egg did. It's just that one day a chicken came out of it, and not something that looked like mom and dad, right? In one step. And that's a pretty big suddenly. It's one thing to think about going from a single-celled plant to a single-celled animal. It doesn't seem like it's that big a step. Now, details, you zoom down in, there's a big difference between a single-celled plant and a single-celled animal. I mean, effectively, it's just as huge as this step. I mean, suddenly you don't have chloroplasts and you have mitochondria, and it's like, what the heck? Right. I mean, everything changes in just one step. But that's, here you've got something macroscopically pretty amazing, to contemplate.
Do you think it happened in a lot of places at the same suddenly?
And then you always have that question, too, right, about whether there's a single suddenly or multiple suddenlies. As you read forward in the story, you can tell there very well could be multiple suddenlies, because you will, even if you have a certain species die off later on, that same thing will come into existence again, because the whole thing's purposed, right? And it's not just purposed, by a magic man putting his finger at one spot and suddenly there's a new thing there, right? It's purposed ubiquitously, right? The whole system is being moved. And so in parallel, you can get a whole bunch of suddenlies, right? And, it may not be literally where you get the exact same species in two places at this, from different suddenlies, but you get two species of trilobite, right? They're all at the same, on the same plane of, the leading edge of the evolutionary process, right?
They must have been little ones to begin with.
Yeah, and they range in from small to quite large. So you can just imagine initially probably some of these things were probably pretty small, because probably the colony organisms were relatively small. But still, it's just an amazing thing to think about. Without anyone just sticking a creature in there while no one's looking, right? You've got something. And, you try to imagine, how exactly did that suddenly occur? It's a pretty impressive feat, right? But think about how you develop, right? You start as a single-celled animal, right, at conception, right? And you go through this same process. And, there's a collection of cells, and every one of those cells is the same for a little while. And then suddenly, right, they start to differentiate, right? And there's a head end and a tail end, and and very specializations of the cells. That whole process, is repeated in essence as you develop from a single-celled animal to a human at roughly age six. Right? In fact, a human. But in truth, you were a human when you were a single-celled animal, right? At conception, in truth, you're a human. You're technically a pre-human. Right. You got to see it's the same thing here, right? In fact, it's a trilobite, but in truth, it's a human. Right? And And it just passed through that point like you do, where suddenly there's differentiation. And again, that's mind, you know, mind is the overarching fact on that matter. Right? It's the conductor of this end is going to become tail and this end is going to become head. Right? It's over controlling that developmental process, the mind engaged from top down on the matter. Same thing here in the you know, the macroscopic evolutionary process. That's that old expression. Ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. Right? The development of you as an individual, you know, is the same basic essence as the evolution of life through the phyla.
Could you say that again?
Ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. Right? Your the individual development of an organism from conception right forward is basically in parallel to the whole evolutionary process over the hundreds of millions of years. Just, you know, just strikes parallel with that. You know, it doesn't do it in literal fashion. It doesn't take you hundreds of millions of years to go from conception to birth, right? Or conception to 6 years old. A lot of that specific detailed evolution is eventuated, is bottled up, right? But it's not totally bottled up. It's not like you come into existence as a full-fledged adult, right? Like some creatures do, you know, in the universe. Like even a secondary midwayer, right? They had no developmental path they went through, right? They just, boom, you've got a full adult. You know, you go through, in essence, that whole evolutionary process with a lot of the details eventuated up, you know, bottled up, and just little bits of evolution, you know, or growth, you know, and, you know, if you talk about it, about a, you know, the development of a single organism like that. Yeah, you got some?
Yeah, I got a question about, you know, we're experimental planet and life carriers, you know, are doing some of these things from experimental. Do you think the suddenlies, you know, like they talk about later on about the sudden appearance of, you know, the Sangha Grace or the races
in one form,
which normally doesn't happen.
Right.
And do you think these types of suddenlies are part of that experimental process in a way on this world?
That's a good little side to throw in. Because it's a decimal world, some of the suddenlies are typical.
Okay.
Some of the suddenlies are atypical, right? The life carriers are, you know, have loosened it up, and they know that there's going to be suddenlies that don't normally occur, species that'll come into existence that don't normally come into existence. But they don't necessarily know exactly when or how. You know, they know basically, but there's a lot of look at that suddenly. You know, even for the life carriers, that's an interesting suddenly. Now, you know, they definitely know that eventually you're going to get pre-colored will creatures, right? So that one doesn't come out of the blue, right? But, you know, they freely admit, you know, there's a number of things that cropped up, and those suddenlies kind of just go off on a tangent and disappear after a while. But, all right, so maybe, you know, generally not caught off guard, but in very precise specificity, occasionally they're surprised by some of the suddenlies on a decimal world.
They learn.
Yeah. Okay.
In the later portion of this time segment, much of North America and Europe emerged from the sea. The crust of the earth was temporarily stabilized. Mountains, or rather high elevations of land, rose along the Atlantic and Pacific coasts, over the West Indies, and in southern Europe. The entire Caribbean region was highly elevated.
Okay, so you know, the basic things, you know, we've already stressed. I'm saying, you know, things are going above the water, below the water, you know, it's constantly fluctuating. See how they wanted to make sure you weren't falling into the current trap. You know, they said, yes, the crust was temporarily stabilized, but not stabilized like actually plates and plate tectonics. Not that stabilized yet. You know, and so when they said mountains, it's like, well, okay, technically we don't have mountains yet. We have high elevations of land. Right? You don't technically have mountains until you have plate tectonics. Mountains are the things that get, you know, shoved up in various ways because of plate tectonics. That's why they threw in that little parenthetical. Right now, you technically just get, you know, this flexing of the earth, you know, producing these big highlands. Right? They may not be super broad. They may be quite localized. So they're basically a mountain range, okay? But they're not a mountain range like we have now. Not a plate tectonic mountain range. There are none. But if you look at a geologist talking about these times, you know, they know about all these various elevations and stuff, and they describe them as plate tectonic mountains, right? Because they've extrapolated plate tectonics backward, and so they're thinking about subduction zones and all this sort of stuff, and see, none of that was happening. Right? Yeah, and it's like, well, couldn't we figure that out? Well, obviously not, see? Right? I mean, we've looked at this for a long time now. That's why the revelators can tell you some of these things, or put in distinct reminders like that. Like, remember, guys, it's not plate tectonics back here. This is just continental drift. And you need to rethink your rationalization schemes. They're not valid. Okay. Yeah, keep going there. Yes. Oh, yeah, is there something on the web here? Yeah.
Brad Garner. Mm-hmm. I was wondering, do you think all the crazy Louis body designs in the Burgess Shale are part of life experiment, or just a way for many designs to try to find the winning one?
Like I was stressing, you know, when you have in these early times, you don't just have the potential greater variability because of the decimal planet issue. You've got a species like, you know, or, you know, type of creature like a trilobite, where basically, you know, they rule the roost on the planet. And so they're dominant in every nook and cranny. And so their horizontal evolution, you know, they get adapted and modified in lots and lots of different ways. You know, they're not forced because of other species, you know, to be kind of just in a localized region. So there isn't much variability, you know, that they can adapt. You know, they just have free reign and they go everywhere. And so, yeah, I mean, just everything, every, you know, just about every potential within them in terms of horizontal evolution eventually finds its place in time. And so you could just get this plethora of different types. Yeah. So just, you know, keep that in mind here, just how much they have, you know, they have free reign. They aren't forced to just be in small areas because something else is dominant in another area, right? And they can't encroach upon that dominance. Let's see. The entire Caribbean region was highly elevated, right? Things like that. I mean, you know, again, think in these very variable terms. I mean, don't think about just flexing things about like they are today, you know. Things have been very different. Thinking of high elevations over the West Indies area of the North American continent and things like that. Okay, keep going.
390 million years ago, the land was still elevated. Over parts of Eastern and Western America and Western Europe may be found the stone strata laid down during these times. And these are the oldest rocks which contain trilobite fossils. There were many long finger-like gulfs projecting into the land masses in which were deposited these fossil-bearing rocks.
Okay, so again, you see that they're reminding you it's not just big scale, but smaller scale undulations, and hence variations in what's underwater and what isn't. Notice, you know, the thing right up front there. We took this much tinier step. We just took a 10 million year step, see. Right, we're going in much more precise fashion, like I said. We're going to step very, you know, very methodically through the Cambrian here in this case, you know, in reasonably small chunks. So you
1.4?
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, you're in that ballpark, and so you just, you know, you think about how much more precision you could bring in and matching up like events. You know, the geologists, oh, okay, I know what event they're talking about there. I date that as such and so. They say it's actually this. Right, so, I mean, I haven't gone into any precision like that, but that, you know, that's all there to be done in much greater precision and see, you know, just how much you could try to pin this down. I mean, you know, the crude way I've done it, you certainly don't want to think about more than two significant digits to that ratio, right? It's a very rough ratio. I mean, you take one specific one, you know, maybe it's more like 1.36, but, you know, you can't think of the three digits as being significant. You know, you should round it to 1.4. Right? You know, that's the sort of thing I'm doing. But you could... you could potentially try to get this more precise and see if you could calibrate the radiometric dating with even a little bit more precision. And look for perhaps shorter term, what appear to be significant variations in that ratio, you know, that you might not see if you just have two significant digits. You know, maybe it's like, well, you know, it actually looks like maybe it really did kind of get smaller and then a little bit bigger here. You know, you could try to, you know, see if you, you know, you could convince yourself that that deduction was valid or not. So we're just taking these little steps now of 10 million years, you know, relatively little. You know, just... notice how things were happening that easily could fool you to think in plate tectonic terms, right? Over parts of Eastern and Western America, right? You know, and they talk about that, or, you know, up there, you know, you saw him mentioning that up above too. You know, and you're starting to think, well, you know, it's just kind of like it is now. You have a Western mountain range and an Eastern mountain range, and right? And, you know, but it's not like it is now. And that's the key. So they occasionally throw in little tidbits like that to just remind you to not get fooled by apparent similarity to now. Okay?
Within a few million years, the Pacific Ocean began to invade the American continents. The sinking of the land was principally due to crustal adjustment, although the lateral land spread, or continental creep, was also a factor.
Again, just see a little aside reminding you of continental drift, not plate tectonics, you know. And so you have the basic undulating thing we've been saying. And then remember, you have just, you know, like they talked about in the previous thing, you have that differential at depth between how much pressure there is down in the depths of the continent compared to the pressure at the bottom of the ocean, right? And, you know, and so the continents creep outward. All right, so just that literal horizontal creep because of pressure differentials at a given given elevation, you know, given radius, you know, from the center of the Earth, and then just the general flexing of the crust. Okay.
380 million years ago, Asia was subsiding, and all other continents were experiencing a short-lived emergence. But as this epoch progressed, the newly appearing Atlantic Ocean made extensive inroads on all adjacent coastlines. The northern Atlantic or Arctic seas were then connected with the southern Gulf waters. When this southern sea entered the Appalachian Trough, its waves broke upon the east against mountains as high as the Alps, but in general the continents were uninteresting lowlands, utterly devoid of scenic beauty.
I see, so... you think, you know, it's relatively localized, but they're not like the Alps, right? They're not a plate tectonic phenomenon, even though they're a relatively, you know, high and localized range of mountains. You know, I mean, they went ahead and just called them mountains, but they reminded you beforehand, you know, don't think literally plate tectonic mountains. See, and so you've got this, you know, they're saying this Appalachian Trough, you've got the waters coming in. You know, so you have a sea, an inland sea, to the west, you know, lapping up against those mountains. obviously, without plate tectonics, you know, there's going to be a tendency for stuff to not, you know, to be fairly flattish, right? Plus, of course, there's erosion going on all the time too, right? Tending to flatten things out. And that also is another way to, you know, that uninteresting lowlands. Because there tends to be lots of lowlands, it's a lot easier for, okay, now it's above the water, now it's below the water, now it's above the water, right? It doesn't take much movement, like they're saying here. So Asia sinks and everything else, you know, goes up. And that doesn't have to be huge, right? Most of North America is underwater. It goes up just a little bit. And now almost all of North America is above water, you know. And that just happened over and over and over again. All right.
Void of scenic beauty. Does that mean no plants? Or does that mean just no...
No, they just mean, you know, the fact that we love to look at mountain scenery because of its ruggedness and stuff. Right? That's what they're getting at, basically. You know, or... you're not going to have a lot of Grand Canyons and stuff like that either, right? Okay.
The sedimentary deposits of these ages are of four sorts. One, conglomerates, matter deposited near the shorelines. Two, sandstones, deposits made in shallow water, but where the waves were sufficient to prevent mud settling. Three, shales, deposits made in the deeper and more quiet water. Four, limestone, including the deposits of trilobite shells in deep water.
Okay, that's fairly basic. But again, there's two things going on, like I've mentioned here. They're not just speaking to giving wonderful clues to PhD geologists. They're also trying to speak to people in general, you know, and help to get the general reader grounded in facts. You know, so they make a point of giving you some basic facts. You know, if you aren't familiar with, you know, that basic sort of differentiation that you know, even if you don't get more sophisticated, at least think in terms of conglomerates, sandstones, shales, and limestone. Right? If you want, you can get all the more breaking it up into, you know, even finer details. But to at least appreciate that in the basic sense of why that is. You know, you're walking along in Wyoming and you're walking on a bunch of shale, right? To think about what you're walking on, right? You're walking on deposits made in the deeper and more quiet water way back when, right? Or if you're traipsing across, you know, a beautiful thick sandstone bed, you know, deposits made in shallow water, but where the waves were sufficient to prevent mud settling. Right? To start to think causally about your relationship to the dirt upon which you tread. Right? They're trying to get you into a logical, causal relationship with the earth. Right? It's not that geologists don't know what a shale is, right? And so you're going, well, why in the heck would they tell us that? Everyone knows what a shale is. Like, no, not everyone. And certainly everyone doesn't think in a more holistic, truthful way about it. Right? It's not just a rock that you can't really see a lot of, you know, sand-like greens in. It's really fine and silt-looking. It's, you know, don't think about it so prosaically and factually. You know, bring it alive a little bit more in your mind. That's what they're trying to get you to do. Okay.
The trilobite fossils of these times present certain basic uniformities coupled with certain well-marked variations. The early animals developing from the three original life implantations were characteristic. Those appearing in the Western Hemisphere were slightly different from those of the Eurasian group and from the Australasian or Australian Antarctic type.
So there, now you can say, oh, that's obviously a helpful clue, right? And the plethora of variations, so you're saying, okay, fundamentally there's three types because literally tied to the three different life groups. And that gets to your question, too, see, about that parallel evolutionary, you know, forcing, right? Yeah, the parallelness of the suddenly. Right, that you've got Western, Central, and Eastern trilobites, to begin with. And then from each of those starting points, they, you know, there's horizontal evolution spreading into, you know, many, 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 many different subtypes. Okay, but that would be, you know, so if you go and start looking at trilobite stuff, you'll see it's like really confusing, and there's, you know, there's trying to find some order in all of that complexity. So here's a little clue to help you sort it. It's like, okay, see if you can try to figure out what those three basic types are. Put them into, see if you can sort them into three bins, and then worry about all the details within each bin. Right, they're giving you a hint. Okay. You know, and it's just, I think everyone, you know, remember how when they use these terms like Australian, Antarctic, you know, remember they're basically talking about that land that eventually is going to end up being solidified into the plates, you know, that have those continents tied to them, right? Yeah. Again, don't think about it literally. It's, you've got Australia and Antarctica even moving around on the planet like they are right now, right? Okay.
370 million years ago, the great and almost total submergence of North and South America occurred, followed by the sinking of Africa and Australia. Only certain parts of North America remained above these shallow Cambrian seas. 5 million years later, the seas were retreating before the rising land. And all of these phenomena of land sinking and land rising were undramatic, taking place slowly over millions of years.
Again, so that it's not cataclysmic, like they said, right? So you don't have catastrophism, right? You basically have uniformitarianism. Yes, it's not simplistically uniform, right? I mean, there's a lot of variability over hundreds of millions of years or tens of millions of years, right? But it's all basically the same idea. You just need to figure out, is this above water or below water? You know, so is this a marine deposit or is this a continental deposit or whatnot? Okay.
The trilobite fossil-bearing strata of this epoch outcrop here and there throughout all the continents except in Central Asia. In many regions, these rocks are horizontal, but in the mountains, they are tilted and distorted because of pressure and folding. And such pressure has, in many places, changed the original character of these deposits. Sandstone has been turned into quartz, shale has been changed to slate, while limestone has been converted into marble.
Okay, so the metamorphic process we've talked about. Now, one thing that if anyone is a geologist or is kind of familiar with this, that you might feel some tension there. When it says sandstone has been turned into quartz, you're going, well, wait a minute, no, not quartz, quartzite. Okay, so yes, technically, quartzite. Quartzite literally means quartz rock. Okay, quartz is the mineral. Quartzite is a rock, you know, and technically this metamorphic rock that the sandstone has been turned into is quartzite. But back in the day, geologists, even, you know, even someone like Charles Lyell, they weren't as finicky about this. Sometimes they would just say quartz. Okay, yes, technically it's quartzite, not quartz. But they just refer to it as quartz because it's kind of a simple distinction because, you know, especially, I mean, some quartzites, I mean, they're basically pure silicon dioxide, and they're basically pure quartz, okay? So just that just reminds you of, you know, they're speaking in that older mode. Plus, again, remember, the point is not to speak in sort of precise scientific terms and get all bogged down in the facts. They're trying to reveal truth, right? They're not trying to give you a science text, right? That's not the point, right? And you could say, see, in the bigger picture, okay, yes, in fact, it's quartzite, but in truth, okay, it's just quartz, right? It's just silicon dioxide. So it's its morphology is a little bit different. Okay, but you know, basically it's silicon dioxide, it's quartz. I'll go ahead and point out, for instance, you know, if you look in Charles Lyell's, you know, text that we talked about, he's got a line where he's talking about metamorphosis. And instead of referring to quartzite in this one spot, he calls it granular quartz and compact quartz. Neither of them does he, you know, use quartzite. You know, other parts of the book he says quartzite, but in that particular spot, you know, he was just, you know, saying quartz. He's talking about the same basic things, you know, they're doing here. And you can see a similar thing in Anstead. He says things like, sandstones are changed into compact rocks of quartz. Okay. I.e. quartzite. Okay. There have been people that have gotten, you know, kind of all wrapped around the axle about simple things like that. It's because their heads are way too down in the details to start with. You got to stay backed off, and you got to think about the historical context that they're striking step to. Right? The book is constructed in an evolutional fashion. The book didn't evolve into existence. It's not evolutionary, but it was definitely designed in an evolutional fashion to match up, you know, with the times. If there's anyone who probably most of you weren't worried about that, but just in case you were,
I didn't know the difference.
Well, now you kind of do.
Now I know the book's wrong.
Now you found an error in the book. It's like no. Right, it shouldn't be changed to quartzite. No one change it to quartzite, you know, in a future printing. Don't do that. It's inappropriate.
Only change
a quart
to quartz.
And again, just, you know, just to help you to be a little bit more of a geologic thinker, when they start saying things like tilted and distorted because of pressure and folding, immediately you should be thinking, we're going to have metamorphic rocks. Right. Pressure and heating is going to modify rocks
and
have you been metamorphosed? Yes.
That's the egg and Donner Steel you skipped over to.
Okay. Now, and just in case you didn't know where slate comes from, okay. It's a metamorphosed shale. Right? Marble. Yeah, if you didn't know where marble comes from. Okay, let's keep going.
360 million years ago, the land was still rising. North and South America were well up. Western Europe and the British Isles were emerging, except parts of Wales, which were deeply submerged. There were no great ice sheets during these ages. The supposed glacial deposits, appearing in connection with these strata in Europe, Africa, China, and Australia, are due to isolated mountain glaciers or to the displacement of glacial debris of later origin. The world climate was oceanic, not continental. The southern seas were warmer then than now, and they extended northward over North America up to the polar regions. The Gulf Stream coursed over the central portion of North America, being deflected eastward to bathe and warm the shores of Greenland, making that now ice-mantled continent a veritable tropic paradise.
Genuinely Greenland. Okay, so a number of things there. You've got, again, you know, you see how they keep reminding you stuff is going above water, below water, above water. You might just wonder why, coincidentally, Wales ends up being mentioned in there. A lot of the naming here is predicated on Wales. The root of Cambrian is an old name for Wales. The region, it's called Wales. It played a significant role in, you know, the early sorting out of this stuff, you know, historically by the geologists. Okay, so you got that little detail. And then there's a really biggie here. This bit about throwing in the supposed glacial deposits. This is a huge issue. Not only do they inappropriately extrapolate plate tectonics backward and have all kinds of false rationalizations of the ancient past, but they falsely extrapolate the Ice Age backwards. Right? That last 2 million years where we've had the Ice Age. You know, they imagine that there's been huge continental-like ice ages, you know, many times way in the past. No. Right? The revelators are trying to insert themselves into that confusion. Right? And reminding people that you may have found a glacial deposit here, yes, but you're falsely extrapolating that, thinking that is over a vast region. It's not. It's just an alpine glacier. Right, or it may even be worse than that. Like they said there, or to the displacement of glacial debris of later origin, right? And you didn't pick up on that. Okay, so this is causing huge problems in interpreting the ancient past. So that's why they throw that in there, try to at least throw a cautionary reminder in. For those who are trying to sort out the geology of the earth, historical geology of the earth. Okay, let's see. And then right there you see him mentioning it. So the climate, it's a marine climate or an oceanic climate, not a continental climate. Right, so you don't have that big temperature differential between the pole and the equator. It's also, doesn't fluctuate very much. You still have that warmer thing about the southern seas. You have effectively a Gulf Stream, right? Even though continents are very different, you still have a big flow of water like that. Of course, it's the central portion of North America way back then. And then the last little detail is kind of along the lines of, No, don't change quartz to quartzite, right? Don't change capital P paradise to lowercase p paradise either, like is often done when this is printed. There's no need to do that. And when you recognize that they even made a point of reminding you of the stone book, quote-unquote, yet again, right? And you have a chapter in there called the pre-Adamite, right? World. Capital P paradise is used, has been used by humans to indicate the Garden of Eden. Like, for instance, at the beginning of the Enlightenment, when Milton wrote a famous book called Paradise Lost. Right? That paradise is the Garden of Eden. Guess what book is quoted at the beginning of Anstead's stone book text? The beginning of the book is a little passage from Paradise Lost. Okay. It's purposely capital P there, just to to don't think generically about the way we use that as a common noun. They're purposely wanting to say that you had a veritable tropical Garden of Eden back then. They want you to think Garden of Eden there, not just metaphorically paradise. They want you to specifically think Garden of Eden, like. Anstead mentioning Adamite and quoting Paradise Lost. Okay. See, like I said, a lot of these changes that seem like you ought to make them to make the text uniform and stuff like this, no, you're breaking relationships to the human source works when you do that. You shouldn't be doing that. You're fracturing the truth of the revelation and your desire to think purely factually. You think about how ridiculous that is. It's a revelation of truth. You know? And you don't understand that. You think it's a revelation of fact. You don't even know what a revelation is. If you start doing this, it's very inappropriate. Simple little details like that are significant. And it doesn't take much hunting to see that. Right? Yeah, some other spot in the book, yeah, it's just the metaphorical paradise, lowercase p, right? Not here. This is tied to Anstead. Right? It's the Garden of Eden. They mean the Garden of Eden. Okay. All right, keep going here.
The marine life was much alike the world over and consisted of the seaweeds, one-celled organisms, simple sponges, trilobites, and other crustaceans, shrimps, crabs, and lobsters. 3,000 varieties of brachiopods appeared at the close of this period, only 200 of which have survived. These animals represent a variety of early life which has come down to the present time practically unchanged.
Okay, there's another one of those something pod. Okay, got that basic foot thing. What's the brachio? That means arms. It's a foot with arms. Yeah, I mean a basic morphology of a brachiopod. If you don't that doesn't conjure up an image when you hear that. All right, you got this basic foot thing that's anchoring it, and it has a pair of of half shell like structures, but not vertically, but horizontally, one above the other. And inside there's kind of two basic arms with, little tentacles on them, for getting food, moving food towards the mouth. Okay. It's a foot with arms. Right? They named these things in very simple fashion, okay? Brachiopods.
The truth of your humanity is your foot used to be in your mouth.
Okay, so, and you see again, how, they're not emphasizing all the suddenlies all the time, but, you've got all kinds of suddenlies happening, and it's just huge. I mean, boom, you got all these different, types of brachiopods. And some of them were, didn't synchronize, with the mother and ceased to exist. Others did, and they're still ongoing. Okay, and that means that somehow their part, they're basically unchanged, like they're saying, right? So, it's like, well, the evolutionary process didn't stop there. Why did they stop evolving? Right? Because again, they're a foundational element in the whole system. Right? The adjutants are founded in the whole mind over living matter system is founded on certain ongoing types of creatures. So we're really starting to see that now, these definitive things where you get them and, way back hundreds of millions of years ago, and you look at one in the water today, and you look at the fossil one, it's like, wow, those are like almost identical. And yet at one point there was nothing even remotely like that, and suddenly there was, there was this totally new morphology and all these different types, and it's like, well, why didn't that just keep going? It's like, because it's all purposed. Right? There's a purpose to all this. Yeah, think about how all these little details that take stress. It's like, think about that. That's trying to suggest to you that there's purpose. Don't think so simple-mindedly about what you're observing. Reflect on it. It shows clear signs of purposing. Purposely, those didn't evolve any further. Just like purposely they evolved into existence in the first place. And the whole system is purposed. A current neo-Darwinist, just the first thing he says, now absolutely, as you examine the fossil record, don't even remotely think of using the word purpose, because you know that's not there. And even more so, don't be tempted to use the word progress. Don't even be tempted to use the word adaptation. That sounds like too much like there's a purpose to the thing. They try to you know, wave their hands and try to avoid the obvious.
What's the other one? Angiogenesis?
Well, there's anagenesis. That's, you know, upward, you know, genesis.
I'm a little bit nervous about that.
Right, I mean, yeah, they don't use that term anymore because that's way too purposeful sounding, you know.
Sounds directional.
Like something is going upward. No, we believe everything is a mindless plane, right? And it's basically the second principle of the Lucifer Manifesto. There is no hierarchy. There is no vertical dimension. It's all anarchism, right? It's all just a horizontal plane. Our science embodies, you know, the falsehood of the rebellion. So that's the sort of stuff they're doing, right? They're trying to just highlight certain things that basically we know, but they're highlighting. So it's like, yeah, you know the fact, but do you know, have you recognized the truth there that's flowing through that fact? What does that suggest to you? Step back, reflect on that. That's telling you something, something profound. All right, keep going here.
But the trilobites were the dominant living creatures. They were sexed animals and existed in many forms. Being poor swimmers, they sluggishly floated in the water or crawled along the sea bottoms, curling up in self-protection when attacked by their later appearing enemies. They grew in length from 2 inches to 1 foot and developed into 4 distinct groups. Carnivorous, herbivorous, omnivorous, and mud eaters. The ability of the latter group largely to subsist on inorganic matter, being the last multi-celled animal that could, explains their great increase and long survival.
See how much horizontal evolution there was there, even going into that niche, you know, and functioning like some of those archaebacteria, like we talked about, some of those prokaryotes, right, that engage in an inorganic metabolic cycle. You know, like, you know, maybe it's fundamentally involved sulfur, say, right, or something. Okay. So very diverse, all of this horizontal evolution. Notice the in the middle there. Another one of those things, like I told you, to keep your eye out for. Curling up in self-protection when attacked by their later appearing enemies. Coincidentally, when they're enemies, they already had the ability to curl up in a ball. Right? That didn't involve in response to the enemies, like current rationalization schemes. Right. That's in the design from the beginning. Right? It's a purposed system. Right? Trying to teach you that. Let's see, any other fun little tidbits there? Just obviously, you can see they started out, you know, they're the dominant living creatures, and then, you know, they proceed to just remind you of that dominancy. Like I said, there's just, it's about the most total horizontal evolution that's ever been possible, right? I mean, it's going to get more complicated here soon, and, you know, you can't have one type of creature just, you know, being everywhere like this, right? So you don't have creatures subsequently that, you know, are quite as variable as they were. And they're just more, you know, confined to certain niches where they could be dominant, you know, without others eating them. Okay?
This was the biogeologic picture of Urantia at the end of that long period of the world's history, embracing 50 million years, designated by your geologists as the Cambrian.
And like I said, so unlike with the such and so Zoic, you know, where the literal etymology is, you know, all of these, you know, they're place names or people in a certain place, you know, I mean, they're, you know, so just, you know, other than kind of curious interest, you know, if you're wondering, well, where were the geologists looking, you know, when they really decided to call these rocks the Cambrian, Oh, they were in Wales. Okay, that's why it's called the Cambrian. You'll see there's, you know, there's historical tidbits like that. But you know, basically, you know, just treat them as a name. Okay, keep going here.
Section 2. The first continental flood stage, the invertebrate animal stage. The periodic phenomena of land elevation and land sinking, characteristic of these times, were all gradual and non-spectacular, being accompanied by little or no volcanic action. Throughout all of these successive land elevations and depressions, the Asiatic mother continent did not fully share the history of the other land bodies. It experienced many inundations, dipping first in one direction and then another, more particularly in its earlier history, but it does not present the uniform rock deposits which may be discovered on the other continents. In recent ages, Asia has been the most stable of all the land masses.
Yeah, so you can see how, you know, a geologist might speculate that. Well, I wonder if, you know, but I can't be totally certain. You know, the Urantia book will just give you that definitive thing. That's the way it was. Okay, you can, so you can build upon that foundation. Right? You don't have to assume, you know, maybe Asia was pretty stable. Okay, you know it was, and so everything can be predicated on that grounded statement. A lot of stuff are doing that. Again, you see that you aren't in a mode where there's even sort of local kind of catastrophic, you know, sorts of things. It's, you're very much in this uniformitarianism mode, as they're stressing there again. All right.
350 million years ago saw the beginning of the great flood period of all the continents except Central Asia. The land masses were repeatedly covered with water. Only the coastal highlands remained above these shallow but widespread oscillatory inland seas. Three major inundations characterized this period, but before it ended, the continents again arose, the total land emergence being 15% greater than now exists. The Caribbean region was highly elevated. This period is not well marked off in Europe because the land fluctuations were less, while the volcanic action was more persistent.
So there's, you know, there's some volcanic action, right? You know, and it does. And there are times when it's greater in a certain, you know, area like Europe here that I'm pointing out. You remember, you know, one of the really important things about when there is volcanic action that allows you to have something that you can date radiometrically. You know, unlike the sedimentary rocks. So it's always very handy to have, you know, some igneous thrown in there. It's like in between these two beds. Like, well, I know what age this is, you know. So this has got to be younger and this has got to be older. And it helps a lot to try to go from just a relative, you know, dating to an absolute dating of the beds. You know, and again, just kind of, you know, thinking of the whole Caribbean region as highly elevated, you know, it's kind of a fascinating picture. And let's see, anything else we have there? Again, you know, they're shallow, right? So, this, yeah, like they're saying, it's very oscillatory. Yep.
The Caribbean region was highly elevated. Yeah. How did the Gulf Stream come out of there?
Well, again, right, it's just, you know, like they're pointing at, you know, the Gulf Stream is moving about in various places, you know. I mean, way back when they mentioned it, okay, it was coming up and flowing, you know, but if that all elevates, okay, then it's going to flow, you know, either to the west or the east of that, or, you know. You know, yeah, and you go, well, was Mexico even there? Okay, you'll see it in a little bit, they mentioned. No, okay, I mean, you got to remember, things were very different, you know, so, yeah. Just that. In other words, they're just saying that, you know, when they say the Caribbean, they mean the southeastern part of the North American continent was highly elevated. Okay. Right.
That's kind of remarkable about the Gulf Stream, though.
Yeah.
Because that there was a Gulf Stream back that long time ago.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming the engine that drives it was much the same as it is today.
Right, that's why they're calling it the Gulf Stream. They're saying, you know, basically that same bit of, you know, of you getting a circulation in the ocean like that, you know, as cold water sinks and, you get this this circulation going. I mean, that can set up any time you basically have the general morphology, you know, that you have today. You know. You have this, the Earth is rotating. You know, all the basic dynamics are in play, like like they are today. Let's see. Anything else there? Again, you just you can see how they make a point of talking in continental drift terms, not plate tectonic terms. You know, they just keep using words. If you notice it, that all match that. All right. You know, they give fun little factoids like, you know, actually saying 15% there. See, yeah, again, they're trying to give you little things. You know, you can't, you know, get that. You know, they're giving you a little data point where you could pin down the story there. So those are for the geologists, those sorts of tidbits, right, to help them be able to pin down. Okay.
340 million years ago, there occurred another extensive land sinking, except in Asia and Australia. The waters of the world's oceans were generally commingled. This was a great limestone age, much of its stone being laid down by lime-secreting algae.
Okay, so see, it's not all animals with shells, building up on the ocean floor and giving you limestone. You've got algae, lime-secreting algae, too. Okay. So, obviously you'll get a lot of very fine-grained stuff from that. If you have all kinds of tiny little things, tiny little shells building up, that'll give you a relatively fine grain. If you have very large shells building up, it's going to be a lot coarser grain. You can get where it's more like a chemical deposit, see, right? You know, than a shell deposit.
Why would algae secrete?
It's like, now let's see. Eventually we need animals that are kind of plant-like that secrete and make a thing called coral. Right, see? They're trying to remind you. I mean, all of the precursors for that are in play. You know, before you have coral, you have the precursors to that. Or even, you've got to secrete and make shells. Right? See, again, they're just reminding you, you can see how that's all built in from the beginning. All right.
A few million years later, large portions of the American continents and Europe began to emerge from the water. In the Western Hemisphere, only an arm of the Pacific Ocean remained over Mexico and the present Rocky Mountain regions. But near the close of this epoch, the Atlantic and Pacific coasts again began to sink.
Yeah, see, they mentioned Mexico. See, only an arm remained over Mexico. So Mexico is getting to be, kind of a something that's there instead of just, as a landmass rather than being, under the water all the time. Again, you might for a time have something, on the Atlantic and Pacific coast that kind of remind you of the mountain ranges you have now. But, you don't have constant, ongoing plate tectonics, on the Pacific coast, keeping, those mountains built up along the western coast. So, no, they're kind of like that for a while, but then it all sinks. And you can see how different it is back then when it's not plate tectonics. All right, and then now we're kind of in the middle of this block of time here, and there's a little tidbit they throw in here as an aside.
330 million years ago marks the beginning of a time sector of comparative quiet all over the world, with much land again above water. The only exception to this reign of terrestrial quiet was the eruption of the great North American volcano of eastern Kentucky. one of the greatest single volcanic activities the world has ever known. The ashes of this volcano covered 500 square miles to a depth of from 15 to 20 feet.
Okay, now, obviously, that's just, an immediate thing. I mean, this is a huge volcano, so there's going to be ash, drifting all over the place, too. Okay. I mean, if you look to the end, of the section, if you don't know what's more recent, immediately recent than the Cambrian, you see it's the Ordovician, right? That's the period we're in here. It's called the Ordovician. And there are these volcanic ash deposits, right, in Kentucky and the other surrounding areas. They're in the middle of the Ordovician. Okay, so here you are. We're right in the middle of the Ordovician, and they're reminding you of that very significant thing. The date they have is not, basically, it's like 325 million years ago. Right, but it's, it's the same event, right? So those they're just reminding you of those very famous, for geologists, ash deposits, volcanic ash deposits there, giving you that touchstone. And telling you something that is, not immediately apparent, that was a very, very major eruption, going on back in those days. In terms of the whole history of the planet, right? You can have Krakatoas and what have you, but, at one time there was a very, very major volcano there. You wouldn't suspect that now, right? Until you dig down into the Ordovician rocks and find all that, that ash there, or bentonite, they might call it, right? But obviously for the things that were in the immediate region there, this could be problematic if suddenly you're buried in 20 feet of ash, right? that could cause some local extinction events. All right, let's keep going.
320 million years ago, the third major flood of this period occurred. The waters of this inundation covered all the land submerged by the preceding deluge, while extending farther in many directions all over the Americas and Europe. Eastern North America and Western Europe were from 10,000 to 15,000 feet underwater.
Okay, if it hasn't sunk in yet, okay, I'm going to use this opportunity to really stress it. Just, like I was stressing, I believe it was last week. Okay, think about how silly it is that we think that, a change in 1 centimeter in the ocean depth or something is some sort of ahistorical cataclysm. I mean, we're thinking in such ridiculous terms, right? Things come and go on a planet like this, right? One time it was 10,000, 15,000 feet underwater, right? Where you're sitting, perhaps. Okay. So it's it's so helpful, just that one fact, just a quick read through these three papers to try to give you a better sense of the fact that you live in an evolutionary domain instead of this existential thing that you imagine you live in. We're acting like we live in Havona, some changeless domain, right? It's not the, the only reason it's been relatively calm for the last few thousand years is, coincidentally, you needed to get civilization going. And I'm putting coincidentally in quotes again, right? Right, we're synchronized. But, once we can handle a little bit, more complexity, don't be surprised if the Earth starts to get a little more complex again. You have a mind. You have a human mind. You can adapt. Come on, use it. Right, you're not a brachiopod. Okay, you can actually move across the land, and you're not rooted in one spot. They're trying to get us to think in more dynamic terms. There's going to be a lot of change between now and the seventh stage of light and life.
Yeah. I don't have to move anymore. I'm an iPod.
I don't have to move. Yeah, an iPod. Yeah, just think about that, yes. You're a foot that's all about you. Okay. All right. Let's get. I think I got everything. I mean, it's just. You just notice that they just keep pounding. I mean, almost every single paragraph said, "Oh, by the way, now it's above water." Oh, by the way, now it's below. You know, and in the same paragraph, it went above and below three times. And okay. They just keep pounding and pounding on that. They know we were going to get hopelessly existentialized in our thinking about the earth. Right? Right.
And the same amount above as below, see? Just crazy swings.
Right.
A few feet.
Okay.
310 million years ago, the land masses of the world were again well up, excepting the southern parts of North America. Mexico emerged, thus creating the Gulf Sea, which has ever since maintained its identity.
Ah, okay. See, that's interesting. So, yes, we haven't gotten to play tectonics yet, but there are some things that are sort of kind of settling in and just change in details, but not in gross fact. In thinking about things like the Gulf Stream, okay, so you can see how that's going to start to settle in to be more of a definitive thing. And you really have that southern part up above the water now. Yeah. I mean, you can tell just from looking at a map today that's kind of the afterthought part of the continent, right? Southern little tail there heading down to Panama. It doesn't look like the forethought part like the Canadian Shield, right? Yeah, so just... it's exactly what you'd expect. Right? It finally comes into play later on in the process. Okay.
The life of this period continues to evolve. The world is once again quiet and relatively peaceful. The climate remains mild and equable. The land plants are migrating farther and farther from the seashores. The life patterns are well developed, although few plant fossils of these times are to be found.
Okay, so just that's obviously a really significant thing to start thinking of these continents as getting green coming in from the edges now. Right, they've been brown in large measure up till now, but the green is starting to creep inward, in a significant way. All right, you notice it's still very much an oceanic climate or a marine climate. Yeah.
This was the great age of individual animal-organismal evolution. Though many of the basic changes, such as the transition from plant to animal, had previously occurred, the marine fauna developed to the point where every type of life below the vertebrate scale was represented in the fossils of those rocks which were laid down during these times. But all of these animals were marine organisms. No land animals had yet appeared except a few types of worms which burrowed along the seashores. Nor had the land plants yet overspread the continents. There was still too much carbon dioxide in the air to permit of the existence of air breathers. Primarily, all animals, except certain of the more primitive ones, are directly or indirectly dependent on plant life for their existence.
Just that last little bit, notice how that's reminding you of how it's a whole system, right? Throwing in a little bit about carbon dioxide. We try to guesstimate what the carbon dioxide level in the atmosphere was going back in time. And, we know it was a lot higher back then. Maybe it was like 10 times or more, what it is today. So that gives you a little idea of when they talk about just little changes, being cataclysmic. It's like, okay, no, you're getting a little bit hair on fire there. Yeah, if you take it too far, okay, it can, it can become too much carbon dioxide. But, there's a pretty wide range where animals are just fine. Plus, not to mention, obviously, if I start to get more carbon dioxide, I'm going to get more plants, and that's going to bring the carbon dioxide down. Or I can begin to take carbon dioxide out of the air and, put it into rocks. As carbonates. It's a complex system, but just, it's a little reminder that, we are in the bigger picture, setting aside our concerns of today, but in the bigger picture, remember we started with an unterraformed planet where basically all it had was a carbon dioxide atmosphere, right? And that's slowly ramping down, and we have an oxygen nitrogen atmosphere that's taken its place. Even now, obviously it's mostly oxygen and nitrogen atmosphere, but that carbon dioxide ramps down slowly over time. You're definitely going to get it down, significantly when you really get the plant life going on the continents. Yeah. We haven't gotten there yet. Let's see. You notice how we are, you're going to find, you could find fossilized worm burrows, perhaps, right, that are not just in totally down to the bottom marine deposits, but stuff that's more on the continental margins. They're pointing out, animals are, starting to, touch upon the land, but no one's scampering across the land yet. Okay.
The trilobites were still prominent. These little animals existed in tens of thousands of patterns and were the predecessors of modern crustaceans. Some of the trilobites had from 25 to 4,000 tiny islets. Others had aborted eyes. As this period closed, the trilobites shared domination of the seas with several other forms of invertebrate life. But they utterly perished during the beginning of the next period.
Those other types. Like they pointed out, the trilobites are very resilient. They're going to keep going as long as any of these types of creatures. Notice again, eventually you got to have eyeballs for humans, right? And we're already working on that. That whole purposing is aggressively in play. And these long-standing creatures, all this horizontal evolution, become these test beds where that, the evolution of eyes is pushing forward in them in all kinds of different ways. All of these sort of, precursors to actual eyes, these eyelet sorts of things, like, some, other arthropods have, like spiders, say. You see how they, they pointed out there, the predecessors of modern crustaceans, like I said, right? Anything else there? Other than just, them actually giving you, tens of thousands of patterns. See, that's like I said, it's really complicated, right? So it's very handy for them to tell you, well, see if you can sort them into three bins to start with, right? Or at least the oldest ones, try to sort them into three bins. Okay.
Lime-secreting algae were widespread. There existed thousands of species of the early ancestors of the corals. Sea worms were abundant, and there were many varieties of jellyfish, which have since become extinct. Corals and the later types of sponges evolved. The cephalopods were well-developed, and they have survived as the modern pearly nautilus, octopus, cuttlefish, and squid.
See how the first two sentences back-to-back? Yeah, if you hadn't put that together already. Lime-secreting algae were widespread. There existed thousands of species of the early ancestors of the corals. See, like I was saying, making sure you made that connection. Right, we had the sea worms, like they mentioned. You've got jellyfish like that. Remember, they told you that you basically have all of the invertebrate stuff all, you know, in play by the end of the Ordovician here. Cephalopods. Okay, that's a foot with a head, right? It isn't obvious. The headedness of those types, you know, like the octopus. You know, and the nautilus, of course, you know, with that pearly inner part of its shell. You know, I think these days they basically just call them, you know, nautilus rather than the pearly nautilus, but, and cuttlefish and squid, right? So, you know, it's like, oh yeah, I know what a cuttlefish looks like, or I know what a squid looks like, and they were basically there way back then. The head foots. Okay, keep going.
There were many varieties of shell animals, but their shells were not then so much needed for defensive purposes as in subsequent ages. The gastropods were present in the waters of the ancient seas, and they included single-shelled drills, periwinkles, and snails. The bivalve gastropods have come on down through the intervening millions of years, much as they then existed, and embraced the mussels, clams, oysters, and scallops. The valve-shelled organisms also evolved, and these brachiopods lived in those ancient waters much as they exist today. They even had hinged, notched, and other sorts of protective arrangements of their valves.
Why don't you just read that last little chunk and then we'll talk about it.
So ends the evolutionary story of the second great period of marine life, which is known to your geologists as the Ordovician.
Yeah, okay, so like I said, the Ordovician, and, okay, so now we have also gastropods, stomachs with a foot. Pretty straightforward. wait a minute, I resemble a stomach with a foot. yes, you do. And the bivalves, you know, like, you know, clams and oysters and whatnot. And if you have, you know, an older printing, you know, you might notice that the spelling of muscle there, you know, as M-U-S-C-L-E-S, rather, you know, rather than the way we spell it now. I mean, that's just the old spelling. That's the way it was spelled in English before it was spelled like it is today. You know, if you happen to have that or are wondering about that. Yeah. They're also a little shelled creature.
Suddenly the spelling of muscle changed.
yeah, you know, what else can you say about a snail, right? It's a stomach with a foot. and a shell. you know, I see it again, you know, mentioning the brachiopods, you know, see the, you know, those two horizontal shells are valves, you know, they're called valves. Let's see.
Hands, feet, stomachs, head.
Yeah. Yeah. See, and see it, and just, you know, that was the point I was just going to make. Yeah. You see it. Yeah. You know, when you go through all of them, you go, wait a minute, it's almost like we have various body parts kind of evolving separately here. Yeah, see how that's working? It's because it's all a purposed system. All right, you're kind of working on heads, you know, you're working on arms, you're working on eyes. You see, they're mentioning all these various parts that are eventually all going to come together in one creature in a very definitive way. All right, but it's all happening well before. And see, now, and you're kind of coaxed again to think about that where they say it directly. There were many varieties of shell animals, but their shells were not then so much needed for defensive purposes as in subsequent ages. Right? See, there it's stated directly. Right? Shells don't evolve in response to predators. Right? It's a purpose system. They have shells before, there's predators. All of this, you see, they're trying to get you, you know, just notice what few things they mention and try to say, why did they mention those things? What's the truth that's flowing through all that? You're getting it. So you picked up on that. It's like, wait a minute, we have different parts of a total body, you know, in each of these. See, there's a truth. There's a wholeness. It's not just, you know, random parts. There's an obvious wholeness to what's going on. Okay. Part of a human is, you know, is embodied in a cephalopod, and part of a human is embodied in a brachiopod, and it's all part of evolving humans. Okay. If I remember correctly, I believe Ordovician is also tied to peoples there in the Wales region. I think we're still kind of stuck in Wales there. Anyway, so see, we're definitely stepping along, and the whole main point is to do what we're doing is to not get bogged down in the facts first, to see the bigger truth. Okay? So if you wanted to be, you know, pursue geology in a very detailed, factual way, you start with the truth of what you're studying, then go to the facts. Right? See a brachiopod anew. See it in the context of the wholeness of the system. You know, don't abstract it out of the whole, and hence never really appreciate the truth of what you're studying in so much exhaustive detail. All right. Let's just stop there, and you can see we're gonna talk more about brachiopods and coral here next time. So let's pick it up where we left off next time.